Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service. I'm Celia Hatton, and I've travelled back to my home country of Canada to explore a mystery that's been unfolding along the winding coastline of the Pacific Northwest for more than 15 years. It started back in August 2007.
We wanted to take a break and get some fresh air, and it was still daylight, so we went to this park.
Michelle Geris and her husband, George Bao, were on a weekend visit to Gabriola, a tiny, heavily forested island off the west coast of Canada. Just a few thousand people live there.
We decided to take this beautiful little trail that was going between houses.
The path they took that day led them to a shocking discovery.
We were walking towards the water and Michelle was in front of me.
And at the corner of my eye, I saw the shoe.
I went into the bushes off the trail and found this thing at the foot of a tree. I think it was a size 11. It's a man's shoe.
It looks different. The way it was sitting, it looked heavy.
You could tell there was something inside.
The knitting of the sock had frayed, and you could see a white mass in there.
It's kind of a greasy white color.
And then he looked for a stick. He found a stick pretty quick. He poked at the shoe, right? To him, it looks like it was a human foot in there.
They'd found human remains. I've come to Canada's coastline to trace this grim discovery of a waterlogged shoe holding a human foot, and how that led to a much wider series of events that would shock people across the Pacific Northwest. Stay with me, and we'll uncover what really happened. But back to that day on Gabriola in 2007. Stopped in their tracks on their nature walk, George and Michelle had a decision to make.
Michelle said, well, maybe we should go to that house over there and ask those people. And they said, no, we're not going to talk to anybody in the houses nearby because they could be involved. So we'll phone this in. And we finally got a signal and then phoned it into 911. And I would have said we found a foot on a trail in one of the parks here. And when I said a foot, I was interrupted and they asked me to repeat. Yeah, and I just said, yeah, there's a foot here, and what are we supposed to do?
This is where the details of this story get even more complex, because this wasn't the first call like this the police had received that week. 6 days earlier, another foot had been found more than 50 kilometers away on another island, Jedediah. And here's the thing. While they were both men's feet, they didn't match. They were both right feet from two different bodies, and that drew the attention of the authorities and the media's interest, too.
They were people from Canada, people from the US, people from England, people from France. The Seattle newspaper, CNN, CBC.
And the discoveries didn't stop there. 6 months later, a third foot was found on Valdez Island. Again, it was male. Again, it was a right foot. And 3 months after that, a fourth on Kirkland Island. While it was another right foot, this time it belonged to a woman. And as the feet continued to be found, speculation surged.
An investigation is underway in British Columbia and Western Canada into a most bizarre series of circumstances.
A human foot has been found near Vancouver.
It's the fifth in the last year.
No one can recall anything quite as bizarre as this.
No apparent connection between them as far as we know.
Plausible theories are somewhat thin on the ground.
This is a very odd story.
I'm Chris Brown. I'm a journalist with the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, the CBC. And back in 2007-2008, I covered the west coast of Canada.
When this all started, Chris was one of the first journalists on the ground covering the story.
I think the first sneaker with a foot washed up in 2007, and not too many people paid a whole lot of attention. And then another one did. But by the time the third foot washed ashore, that's when we started saying, huh, this might be something very unusual.
And by the summer of 2008, the discoveries had gripped the public's imagination.
People began to wonder, one, two, three, maybe that's a coincidence, but five? There's got to be something else going on here.
Without any obvious answers, it seemed that everyone had a theory to explain what was going on.
Vancouver is a lovely city, but it also has a dark side, and everyone who lives there knows about it. There's a terrible drug trade that goes on that's left big part of the city very impoverished. There's criminal gangs that operate there. And we've had, in Vancouver, some terrible crimes, mass murders. And so when you sort of throw these feet in with that kind of backdrop, that's what really sort of fueled the speculation.
Since 2007, feet have continued to be found in the area, a total of 24 so far. Left feet started turning up too, and some have been found south of the border in Washington State in the U.S.
It's an area that collectively became known as the Salish Sea. So some American parts of the ocean, some Canadian, the mouth of the Fraser River. And so this was a vast stretch of territory.
Thank you for sailing with BC Ferry.
Welcome to Gaborola.
I've traveled to Gaborola Island, where Michelle and George first made their discovery back in 2007. This is an exceptionally beautiful part of the world. In front of me are pristine waters. I've seen heron diving for fish. For many, this is paradise. The discoveries disturbed that paradise. Every time a foot was found, a new crime scene would be cordoned off along the coast.
My name's Allison Cameron. I'm a member of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, or the RCMP, and I'm a member of the RCMP's Forensic Identification Service in British Columbia.
Each foot led to a call to the police, triggering an investigation.
So the thing that we began trying to work out was how could you work your way back to a scene from a location as vague as a beach at the beginning until we knew an identity and the circumstances of how that person ended up in the water. It was a bit frustrating because you didn't have a location, you didn't have anything reported, and you had to wait for a name because, of course, you had to wait for a DNA profile to get a name.
It was hard to rule out suspicions that grisly murders could have led to the deaths behind the discoveries, particularly with a history of violent crime around Vancouver.
We have a gang conflict going on right now, and the most common scenario involves someone traveling to shoot a rival and then leaving that scene quickly in a vehicle that's been stolen and then driving it a few miles away and then setting fire to it. It started off, I think, as a means of disposing of evidence, but it's also kind of a flash thing, kind of a dramatic signature sort of thing.
When the first feet turned up, the police questioned if this gang activity could be involved.
We began to wonder, is this something new? Is this a new signature? I think everyone was thinking the same thing. How is it possible that this could happen so close in time and so often and it not be something that's the result of human activity?
So we have a series of human feet found washed up on shorelines around the Pacific Northwest with no obvious connections. And we have theories over what could be behind the mystery, ranging from serial killers to violent gangsters. Identifying who the feet belong to could help lead to a breakthrough. And that's where the coroner comes in.
These are not unidentified cases. These are recoveries.
Laura Yezegin is an identification specialist with the British Columbia Coroner's Service. She's responsible for all of the cold cases in the province that involve unidentified remains, with some dating back as far as 1962. The work of trying to identify the feet fell to her. A tough job since they'd been separated or disarticulated from the other parts of the body that usually make identification easier.
There's not a lot that you can tell from just a disarticulated foot. A couple of cases, there have been lower leg bones as well attached, which kind of gives you a little bit more information. You can, you know, estimate the height of an individual from the length of the leg bones. And it's usually easier to tell right away whether the person is male or female from that.
If you can't determine much information from the feet themselves, what about the other pieces of evidence that were found with each discovery? The shoes.
The good thing about having the shoe is that there's actually a lot of information that you can get from the shoe itself. So on the tongue of the shoe, there is almost always a manufacture date. And then we know that the person can't have gone missing before that time, because if the shoe was manufactured or distributed in 2013, the person can't have died in 2012.
At this point, Laura produces a large brown paper bag marked with the word evidence. Out of it, she pulls a black and blue running shoe with a neon green N on the side and brightly colored laces. One of the 24 pieces of footwear that were found with human remains inside.
This is a size 12D New Balance runner, the right shoe.
You know, I've got to say, that shoe is in amazingly good condition. I would have thought it would be more beat up and sort of ripped apart. Is that...
It was in the water for 3-ish years. So, yeah, I mean, it's plastic, right? Like, it's all synthetic.
While these observations of both the feet and the shoes can offer some clues, there was one testing method that helped Laura more than anything else.
The DNA test is absolutely key. Yeah, we couldn't identify these without the DNA, basically. You know, even if we did have somebody come and say, yes, definitely, my loved one went missing wearing this exact shoe, well, they're not the only person in the world who ever bought that shoe, so we can't say for sure it's that person. Identification of our unidentified human remains would be impossible without having reference DNA profiles from family members of missing persons. We have a DNA database in-house here that has reference profiles for over 1,100 missing persons, historical missing persons in BC, many, many of whom have gone into the water.
One final revelation from Laura. Examinations of the bones showed that none of the human feet had been mechanically severed from the body, meaning they hadn't been cut off. So how did the feet become separated from the rest of the body? A question for another scientist a short journey away. You're listening to the documentary from the BBC World Service, and a caution here. For the next few minutes, the research we describe is a bit grisly. To try to understand what happened to these feet before they washed ashore, I've come to Simon Fraser University in the Vancouver suburb of Burnaby.
So this is just a multiplayer.
Swiping me through security door after security door is Dr. Gail Anderson, a professor in the university's School of Criminology. The reason for all the security... Gail's high-profile lab handles forensic evidence from real crime scenes, often from murder cases.
This is the entranceway for the bodies to go through.
And as we get into the lab, we're greeted by an unusual sight. A huge box containing thousands upon thousands of flies. Gail is one of the world's leading forensic entomologists. She studies insects found on or around dead bodies. After several feet had been discovered, the BC Coroner's Service contacted Gail.
I was called in by the coroners in all the cases and asked to come and look at them and collect any insects or other kind of arthropods or anything I could from the feet and try to estimate an elapsed time since death, which is what, as an entomologist, I do. In all of these cases, I really couldn't tell them very much. They were in the water, so there's no insect colonization as such. And they were remarkably well preserved, because when any form of tissue is in an anaerobic environment, a low-oxygen environment, it becomes adipocere tissue.
Adipocere. Do you remember earlier when Michelle and George on Gabriola Island described seeing a greasy white mass inside the shoe they found?
It's the fats from your body, and they either leach out or they're still in the body, and they become this white, waxy, when it's dry, putty-like material when it's still wet.
Gail has carried out a number of experiments looking at what happens to bodies when they're left in water that involved anchoring the bodies of dead pigs into waters near Vancouver.
Pigs are considered the closest thing to humans. They are relatively unhairy, like we are relatively. You hear about more and more organ transplants being used. They're pigs. And we can get the roughly right size to match your torso.
The experiments involved using underwater cameras to film the pig specimens to see what happens to them. At the time, there'd been little research into how long it takes bodies to break apart in water, and the results took everyone by surprise.
We were all shocked by how very fast we could get complete skeletonization. I mean, we knew that a body could break down much faster than most people believe. But I don't think any of us were quite ready for how quickly the body was completely engulfed and gone in 3 days.
What Gale found was that a range of deep-sea scavengers, like shrimp, crabs, and lobsters, were feeding on the bodies of the pigs and breaking them down quicker than anyone had previously understood. So what happens to a human body when it's in these conditions? And what happens around the feet?
So around here, on the ankle area, that's where all those little bones are and where those joints are and where the tendons are going to break away and get eaten. And once that's all been eaten, the foot's just going to fall off. Now, normally the whole foot would go, but when it's enclosed in some sort of a running shoe, it's just going to stay in there.
We know from Laura the coroner that the feet found on the coastline weren't cut off in some kind of gangland ritual. And instead, as Gale explains, they appeared to have separated from the bodies naturally in the water. But there's still a mystery surrounding the floating feet. How did they come to be found where they were, spread out, seemingly at random, across the shoreline of the Pacific Northwest?
What I love to do is look at the water, see how clear it is. This is just a classic view.
I've traveled south across the Canada-US border to Seattle to speak to someone who's been following the discovery since the very beginning.
My name's Kurt Ebbesmeyer. I've been an oceanographer in this area since 1966, and I've been studying these waters for all those years up to the present.
Kurt has studied ocean currents by finding ingenious ways of mapping their movements. In 1992, for example, nearly 30,000 plastic bath toys fell off a container ship into the Pacific Ocean. Kurt used an international network of beachcombers to track where the toys washed ashore over decades, with some of the toys traveling more than halfway around the globe. Because he knew where the objects had entered the water, he could build up patterns of where the currents had taken them. But in cases like the feet discoveries, he says it's almost impossible to decipher where they came from.
The shoe, we know where it wound up on the beach. But we don't know point A. We don't know where it started. So we don't know the life history of that shoe with the bones.
While we can't uncover where the shoes came from, can we predict where they might be found?
You know, the world is pretty simple. It's got land and it's got water. But between the two, there is a coastline. And what hardly anybody realizes is there's a million miles of that coastline. And what people don't, even scientists don't, really appreciate is that of all the flotsam in the world, about 90% of it's going to wash up on just 10% of that shoreline. Now, if you're a really good beachcomber, in your neck of the woods, you will know where those places are.
Kurt also believes he knows the answer to another interesting question about the discoveries. Why have more of the feet been found on the Canadian side of the border than the U.S. side?
Canada doesn't have dams on rivers like we have in the U.S. So if somebody's lost in a water body, they can wash out into larger water bodies, whereas down here they'll probably be washed into a dam and the police will come down and take the remains. So that's one major difference.
As these scientists have told us, any human body that ended up in a major river in western Canada would likely be carried out into the ocean. Sea creatures would then consume much of the remains, causing the feet to separate naturally from the body. But there's still one big unanswered question. Why did this suddenly start happening? That's something that puzzled journalist Chris Brown, too.
Obviously, Vancouver is a port city. It's on a river. It's on the ocean. Sometimes human remains are found. In this case, what got people talking is, Why now? Why were these feet being found and being found in running shoes all over the West Coast?
We know that for a range of tragic reasons, whether it's people drowning or taking their own lives, bodies have always ended up in the waters around the Pacific Northwest. So if that's the case, then why did these feet only start being found in 2007? Well, the answer to that lies in something we've already heard. Do you remember earlier at the BC Coroner's Service, identification specialist Laura Yuzedjian showed us a shoe from an evidence bag? It was one of the running shoes that had been found with human remains inside.
This is a size 12D New Balance runner, the right shoe.
You know, I've got to say, that shoe is in amazingly good condition.
What Laura said next holds a clue to the mystery.
It was in the water for 3-ish years. So, yeah, a bit. I mean, it's plastic, right? Like, it's all synthetic.
It's all synthetic. While we've been focusing on the feet, should we have been looking a little closer at the shoes?
General admission? $1 and 2 kids under 5. Thank you.
In Canada's biggest city, more than 3,500 kilometers east of Vancouver, is a building that's home to the world's largest collection of shoes and footwear.
My name is Elizabeth Sumelhack, and I'm the director and senior curator of the Bata Shoe Museum in Toronto.
The shoes that were discovered on the coast all had something in common. They were running shoes, and what they were made of is important to this story.
If you use materials that cannot be waterlogged, then you have something that can float. And also, in addition, they are plastic, so they are both preserving, they're holding the foot inside, but they're also not being weighed down by absorbing water. And so once the foot is disarticulated from the ankle, now it's in a very buoyant container, right? And so it is rising to the surface and being pushed to the shores. And so because of the trend within the sneaker industry to make lighter and lighter and lighter shoes, we are seeing, I think, these shoes now showing up in this situation.
The design of these shoes and even the very materials they're made from have constantly evolved over the last 50 years. And Elizabeth says that is why the feet started floating to the shorelines of the Pacific Northwest.
This drive to make lighter shoes, which starts in 72, it just increases exponentially. And so you have the invention of Crocs. I think they come out in 2003. Right now you have a completely foam shoe. You have just these insights continually being made into how light the upper material can be, how light can the foam be that can be used for the sole, and you combine these two together and you end up with the situation that we're facing.
So it was the shoes all along that held the key to this Canadian mystery. And that explains why each time a foot was found, it was inside the same type of shoe, a running shoe, with the right mix of materials to float on the water and be washed ashore. And once these details were clarified, the story changed. The media frenzy tapered off, leaving behind a different focus on the people behind all of this, those who died. We understand that almost all were victims of drowning or had chosen to take their own lives.
I think it drove home for me just how many people have sadness in their lives and how many people would choose to end their lives like this.
Journalist Chris Brown.
You know, I talked about how in Vancouver there is a lot of drug use and there's a lot of sadness and frankly wretchedness in many parts of the city. But when you start to, you know, break it down, well, this is someone who experienced that, and this is kind of the outcome. And I think that was a challenge for all of us telling this story, was not to kind of get sucked into the wow, the mystery of it. And you have to try to remember that these were people we're dealing with who died clearly in a very tragic way.
Each of these people had their own story. And while the work Laura Yuzedjian carried out at the coroner's service to identify them was painstaking, it got results.
All of the feet are identified. We do not have any open, unidentified feet at this time.
With each identification, there comes an answer for the families of those who've gone missing.
My position is unique in the coroner's service. Most of my colleagues are talking to people like on the worst day of their life, right? Someone has just died. It's a really traumatic time. Most of the families I talk to are actually happy to hear from me. You know, they've been waiting for these answers. They've been waiting for them for a long time, even if it's only a couple of years. But if, you know, some of them are 40 years, we're at the position now where we have a really good system in place. So we know if a call comes in, that a new foot has been found, that we have all of the steps in place. We know how to go about what we're going to do to try and identify the person. And it's always a mystery each time. Like when one of these turns up, you just wonder who it could possibly be, where could they have come from.
You've been listening to the documentary from the BBC World Service, unraveling the mystery of why human feet began washing up on the beaches of the Pacific Northwest. In the end, the shoes were the key to solving this puzzle, an example of how changes in modern technology can have unintended consequences on the world we live in. And in this case, how it helped to deliver the most basic of comforts, the confirmation for worried relatives of what had happened to their loved ones, not just feet, but also answers that were found on the shoreline.